Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Hello everyone and welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard.
We finish today where Her Majesty will finish her royal drive at the gates of her palace in London.
My name is Marcus Speller. Jonathan Wilson sat opposite me smiling away. And this time around, we have Seb Stafford-Bloor, editor, content editor of TiVo Football, writes for Football 365 and 442. Seb, lovely to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Marcus.
Now, Seb, you have picked a game which I think is the oldest game so far, or it will be one of the oldest games I'd imagine that we'll have on this series. It's the 1953 FA Cup final where Blackpool beat Bolton Wanderers 4-3. An absolute classic. The Stanley Matthews final is dubbed this game, of course, much to the bemusement, I suppose, of Stan Mortensen, who scored a hat-trick in the final. But why have you gone for this one, Seb?
I think, Marcus, it's such a big topic. I think if you sat three guys down around a table and asked them to talk about the 53 Cup final, the conversation can go in so many different directions.
But it depends which three guys present.
I suppose so. But
you just so happen to be with Jonathan and I today, Seb.
I think kind of even if you're a casual football fan, you know the 53 Cup final as the Matthews final. You probably know about Stan Mortensen's hat-trick. But then, depending on your interest, you can go deep into it and you can go on these sort of offshoots into, of course, 6 months later, England are getting humbled by Hungary at Wembley. Mm-hmm. You can go back, you can explore the kind of the nature of English football at the time. But also, the more you read and the more you find out about it, the more you realise that whilst superficially there are so many differences to see in the game, then there are trends and themes within it which really persist to the current day, to the present day. And it's very rich. I'm not sure, I mean, 4-3, it sounds like a better game than it really is, I think. I mean, even excusing the caveats about sort of the footage, obviously the first FA Cup final that the BBC broadcast, I'm not the biggest Kenneth Wilson home fan. So take all of that.
He's a shocking commentator who produced a great line at a great moment, which is massively kind of inflated his reputation.
You know what's really interesting? I've always imagined Kenneth Wilson home to have been 65 in perpetuity. Yeah. So you just that's how you imagine him.
Oh, yeah.
He's 32, 33 when he's covering this game, and he's talking about there are moments during the game where Matthews is dancing down the right wing, and particularly during the last sort of 15 minutes, and he's saying things like, "Oh, right now, come on, Stanley, what are you going to do here?" And he sounds like his dad, Stanley. Yeah. Matthews. Stanley Matthews is 38 at the time this game's happening, and you're talking about a guy that's actually younger than I am now, and it's just interesting. It's kind of, I have this visual image of quite an elderly gentleman and sort of not really the he goes through the final by talking about this fullback he came into the team a couple of weeks ago, and it's a football commentator for people that don't really like or are interested in football. It's sort of your entry point for a lot of people,
but I think that's actually exactly. that is true, and I think one of the you're absolutely right that there's an extraordinary number of trends coming together in this game.
Yeah.
And actually, probably the least important of them is Stanley Matthews.
Yeah.
But one of the key trends is, I think you can make a very good argument, this is the first time the football becomes the mass sport. And I suspect we'll come on to that. But yeah, for a lot of people watching, they wouldn't have known anything about football. They certainly have no idea about how football should be covered. Because as you say, it was the first final to be broadcast live by the BBC. And the first time that a lot of people had televisions.
Yeah.
You know, the coronation was a month later. The coronation was June the 2nd. This game was May the 2nd. The coronation was an event for which a lot of people bought or rented their first TV. And so a lot of them got it a month early so they could watch the cup final.
This was the warm-up to the coronation
they think maybe as many as 12 million people watched the game, which is, if you think of the figures we're getting, say, the Women's World Cup now, where mm-hmm. you know, we're sort of talking about 6 to 7 million as being an extraordinary figure, which it is, mm-hmm. 12 million in those days for anything, okay, there's only one channel, but it's still a mass event in the way that probably nothing had ever been before.
Mm-hmm. It's actually amazing to look at. I was ill over the weekend, and so while the rest of the country was sitting in parks getting a suntan, I was sat in bed drawing sort of tenuous spider graphs about all the things that had happened in 1953. And in retrospect, it must be an amazing time. If you're a television journalist at the time when sort of television starts to take over in this country, as a year, I made a list of the things that happened, the things that everybody knows about. So obviously the coronation, sugar rationing ends later in the year, and Everest gets conquered, I think, at the end of April, 29th of April.
It's not far before. A couple of
days before the... Okay, so it's at the end, end of May. Other than that, though, we've got Tito becoming president of Yugoslavia, which is a pretty seismic event, obviously, mm-hmm. with a few decades of hindsight. Nikita Khrushchev comes to power in the Soviet Union. The Oscars are broadcast on television for the first time. Fleming publishes his first James Bond novel, which I think is Casino Royale. And the Rosenbergs were executed for espionage. So it's like this, and Arthur Miller's The Crucible opens on Broadway as well. So there's all these things.
Gordon Richards wins the Derby for the first time. There you go. 46.
I think the sound barrier gets broken for the first time. So 53 is
what a year.
My mum was born in 53. I kind of have to mention that. She listens to everything I do, so yeah, it's... Yeah, yeah.
She'd be pleased to be mentioned in the same breath.
Exactly, I always try and work her in like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Rosenbergs, yeah, you know.
Let's pick up on that TV point, because I think one of the things that happened was, I think this is the moment which you can say this is when football becomes the national sport rather than cricket. So it's this 4-3 classic, as people sort of, I agree with you, it's not as good
it's
a game as that
game.
Makes it sound.
Yeah.
But still, 4-3 is exciting. Mm. Just come back from 3-1 down, we'll get into the flow of the game later. And I think what's really telling is that on the radio, on the BBC Light programme, they only broadcast the commentary of the second half. Mm. In the first half, they were concentrating on the Australian tourist cricket team playing at, I think it was Leicestershire, and Hampshire v Essex in the county championship. And Neville Cardus, the great cricket writer, the Guardian's cricket correspondent through the 20s and 30s before he moved to Australia, came back after the war, and he was primarily a music critic by then, but he ended up writing for the Manchester Guardian, as it then was, on the Ashes that summer. But he wrote a letter to the Times. It's quite a weird thing that a freelance journalist would just give away words for free. But anyway, he'd been to Lords, not far from Wembley at all. I mean, these days, what, 4 or 5 stops down the Jubilee
Something
line?
Like
those
that,
days,
yeah.
I guess you get the Metropolitan line from Baker Street. But, mm-hmm. but anyway, yeah, just close together, the two homes of the homes of the two great English sports. And he went to watch the first class game of the season, which is the MCC against Yorkshire. And this is what he wrote. Play was not possible until 3:15. Then the players came into the field, and in an hour, 20-odd runs were scored without a sign of a daring gesture, without a hint of personal relish. And then, after an hour of what I can fairly call a creeping paralysis, the players left the field for tea. The small crowd looked on in silence. As I departed from the ground, I felt pretty certain I'd been attending a decaying contemporary industry, which, but for the artificial respiration applied from time to time by the Australians, would before long pass into the hands of the brokers and gradually disappear, not greatly lamented, into profound oblivion.
My goodness.
It's wonderful. Right?
Which, yeah, and to be fair, he probably could produce that every year since about cricket. and probably had been producing it for 50 years before that. But he then made the point that Geoffrey Green, the great football correspondent for the Times, had in his match report on the game spoken of football as the game of the people. A few years earlier, Cardiff said he'd have been up in arms about that, but he now accepted that he was probably right.
Well, when he talks about a small crowd and a very humble affair, as you say, just down the road, I mean, what is the official attendance? 100,000?
100,000.
Perhaps maybe a few more in there, but it's certainly an enormous crowd who are treated to... Okay, in terms of quality, not brilliant, but it was a 7-goal, you know, an amazing ending to the game. And you can see how it kind of swings. But yeah, let's
go through the names. Sure. It's a 2 minutes in, Bolton take the lead. Do you want to talk us through one of the great Wembley goals?
George Farmer's a Scottish international. Let's say that before we get going. Also became a lighthouse operator in later life, which is just the wonderful metaphor for goalkeeping. One of the worst goalkeeping mistakes I think I've ever seen at Wembley. For people who haven't seen, he has another one a couple of minutes later.
Just
a few minutes later. But imagine everyone remember Scott Carson's famous moment against Croatia at Wembley. Mm. Imagine that, but without all the asterisks relating to the weather.
Yep.
And so Loftus kind of scuds one in from about 20 yards, and I don't know what George Farm was doing. Apparently he had a very strange technique when he was trying to catch the ball. So obviously modern goalkeeping, this might not be great podcasting content.
It'll be 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly. Not dissimilar to the driving position, yes. Basically. Whereas Farm liked to catch it at 12 o'clock
and six, yeah.
which is a
Aussie rules a bit, isn't it?
A little bit Aussie rules, a little bit. But
a child playing cricket, isn't it? This sort of
a little bit. A child who's afraid of the ball and sort of wants to protect his face, and you just think, I'd love to meet the succession of coaches who refused to coach that out, because you think right in 10 years' time you're going to be at Wembley, and his body. If you look at that goal now, even through the television quality at the time, the broadcasting issues, it's not good. Mm. It's not the posture and the technique and the addressing the ball. He sort of collapses into it, and I think he gets a little bit of shoulder, but it can only sort of deflect it into the corner of his own net, and it's. And Wolstenholme goes off on this kind of, now I was a goalkeeper and I can tell you that's very, very embarrassing. I'm not sure that was entirely necessary for him to add, even for people that were new to the game, because it's ugly.
It's quite funny to hear, as you say, a man who was, what, 32, saying, well, I was a goalkeeper.
You know, back in the day.
He can still be playing if you want.
Yeah, exactly. He's very, very strange. I mean, he makes it sound like he was taking part in village games with sort of 50 players aside, and, you know.
Which perhaps he did. You never know with old Kenneth. But, so 1-0.
And Bolton very much on top.
Yeah.
Loftus hits the post.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then the follow-up, Willie Moyer, the captain, his shot's blocked on the line. And then 10 minutes before half-time, Stan Hansen, the Bolton goalkeeper, has his moment in the sun.
Yeah, it wasn't a game for the goalkeepers, I have to say.
No, it wasn't. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Kind of the deflection, because Wolstenholme calls it at the time. He calls it as a hassle own goal. And obviously it's sort of gone down in it's the first Wembley hat trick, and he concedes ugly. Ugly.
But then, essentially Mortensen finds space at the back of the box, and his shot does take a slight deflection, but
it's an own goal.
It's
an own goal. Probably. I mean, I would actually argue that kind of the worst area is for Mortensen second in the second half when it kind of
we'll get there.
I'm jumping. I mean, we're just piling on the goalkeepers, aren't we? It's not very fair.
And by this point, Eric Bell, the Bolton left half, is already limping pretty badly.
No substitutions in those days.
It's a torn hamstring, isn't it, rather than a pulled hamstring?
Yeah, but I mean, he's like...
you see him...
It almost looks like... It's so bad, limp. It almost looks like he's putting it on really badly. He's like really dragging the leg.
Exactly that. You sort of see him in the coverage. Every now and again, he kind of limps into shot. It's a strange thing. It's actually, there's a tactical point there to be made, because obviously he gets injured and Bolton try and hide him, basically. Mm-hmm. They stick him out onto the left wing, and you think, right, given who you're facing and given where the danger in that side is, where would you put your useless player? And it's something about, I remember I was reading Jonathan's book actually a couple of weeks ago about how, about the England's 4-0 win in Turin. Mm-hmm. About how there's a point in the game where Italy are completely dominant.
This is
1948, right? And England are getting battered, and Stanley Matthews is just kind of watching on from the halfway line on its wing, just saying, this is a, they're really, really playing very, very well, aren't they? And it's just interesting for me, because to see a point at which I know the imperatives around wing play and defensive responsibilities have changed, but it's just interesting when you think, yeah, that's, you know, I'll just stay here and watch. Yeah. It's like,
well,
it's
actually, like, that same year, 48 in the cup final, when Manchester United played, yeah, Blackpool, Matt Busby, who's sort of thought of now, and even by the 60s was thought of as being pretty laissez-faire in his approach to tactics. Mm. And he got Charlie Mitten, United's winger, essentially to man mark Matthews. And Matthews apparently was saying to Mitten all the game, this really won't do. Yeah. You're not going to get any headlines doing this. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But they did get the cup. So.
Well, there you are. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting when you kind of map it out like that, just the differences in the game. I mean, I think, talking of the goalkeepers, Farm, the goalkeeper, I think it was, didn't he score in his professional career? Was it Farm?
Possibly.
Because he got injured and was put up front or something like that.
I don't know.
But it just showed, I think it might have been Farm, but that shows you, back in those days, no substitutes. Mm. Okay, well, we don't want to go down to 10 men unnecessarily. So
Farm, I can confirm, in 461 games to Blackpool, did score one goal.
There you are.
Interesting, interesting. Okay.
Anyway, back to the final, though, itself.
So 4 minutes after the equaliser, Farm,
yep,
gives another one back.
Might I say that was worse?
Yeah, I think it probably was.
I think it looks
worse
because he comes sort of starfishing out of his goal.
So Moya lifts the ball into the box. Yeah. It's sort of a cross at sort of 45 degrees or so. There appears to be very little pace on the ball.
It's the heavy ball as well, so it's not moving, it's not flying.
Yeah, I mean, the camera angle, there's a camera angle from behind the goal, which I think is where it looks awful.
The
Farm comes out. Loftus, I guess, is a man you probably don't want to clatter into. As
we hadn't had the 58 World Cup yet.
When Loftus scores against Manchester United. And they both miss it, and the ball sort of very gently sort of
over the line.
Plops over the line.
Yeah.
So there's a Bolton, a 2-1 up at half-time. And then 10 minutes in the second half,
Bell scores.
The injured Bell.
Yeah.
Managed to get a goal.
Sort of rises. I think I can't really make it out. I think it's Eddie Schimmel he gets up ahead of in the box. Just rises like a salmon despite, you know, torn hamstring and all. Mm. And scores. And actually,
it's kind of the first proper goal of a game.
It's the only, I'd say, it's the only sort of non-chaotic goal in the game. Mm. Apart from the free kick, but set piece.
Oh, I don't think you're being harsh on the seventh goal as well, but
I don't know. I mean, certainly, if you read Matthew's autobiography, it's kind of a little bit of a happy accident in the end, because I don't think he's aiming for Perry. He's aiming for Mortensen.
Because Mortensen kind of lets it go or doesn't.
And Mortensen sort of has this spiel afterwards where he talks
about
it.
Anyway, we'll do that in order. Yeah.
We're doing that. And if you watch the celebration, Bell scores and a couple of his teammates gather around him, and then the whole team starts sort of thronging towards him, and people saying, no, stay away from him. He's going to become even more useless. Right. It's an amazing thing, actually, just to see. And Jonathan said earlier about the kind of how pronounced his limp is and how immobile he is for what's, I think, that goal's in the 58th minute?
55th, I think.
55th minute. So he's been, gets injured after 18 minutes. So he's been limping around Wembley for, you know, for a good half an hour plus.
And still manages to
score. Still manages to score.
Maybe they got something into him at half time to take the pain away. I don't know.
Conspiratorial.
Just give him painkillers. I mean, there's nothing.
I don't know if it's a torn hamstring, though.
He's still numb the pain.
He's got some strapping on. I think sort of Wolstenholme is tracking that in the first half when he goes off for treatment. He's like, I've got some strapping on. I don't understand what that's supposed to do, which is, there was a war 8 years earlier. So it's kind of, I'm not sure.
A torn hamstring's a big issue in the war?
No, but I mean, in terms of strapping and you know, the appearance of strapping for people who appear to be injured, I reckon probably.
Yeah, okay.
Probably there aren't even torn hamstrings in the second.
Well, yeah.
One of the problems was, of course, that they just didn't warm up properly.
They didn't. There's no stretching. It's really.
Well, first of all, was going over the top.
But. Just leapt into action and just, you know.
Indeed. Well, Bolton then went, as I say, 3-1 up. And it looked like a pretty decent lead. And the way the game was going, it was a long way back for Blackpool. But they went through the gears and they. And
would slowly Matthews.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, really late. Mm-hmm. Matthews begins to assert himself, given that he's, you know, essentially Blackpool have an extra man down there, right, which is where their biggest threat is coming from. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, 68 minutes halfway through the second half, Matthews goes past Malcolm Barris, the centre-half. So I don't even really know where the left-back had disappeared to.
No.
But Barris had a go to meet him, and Matthews sees him coming, just sort of darts past him, crosses. Hansen fumbles, obviously. another goalkeeping error. And there's Mortensen at the back post to knock the ball in. But fumbles is too generous, even. It's sort of...
It's a flap.
You can't imagine an easy cross for keeper. And
it's high, it's floated. He's not really under pressure until after he drops it. It's not many caveats. I think it's strangely iconic in a way, because Mortensen somehow manages to score. You can't really see how he does it. And he seems to climb with the post and get what looks like a fairly major concussion in the process. Mm. If you see him get up, he's all over the place. He has to actually be dragged back to his feet by his teammates. And that fits very neatly in with the kind of the story of Mortensen's life. I mean, in a different world in which this wasn't about Stanley Matthews and him winning his cup final medal for his dad and that kind of thing, and given who Matthews was, you would recognise the guy who nearly died in a Wellington bomber during the war, during a training exercise. But, you know, I remember there's a chapter in Hot Cross Football Man where he interviews Mortensen years afterwards, and he can still see the scar at the base of his skull from the accident. I think, I don't think he was the only survivor. I think everyone died apart from a pilot who lost a leg, but he was the only person to come out unscathed. So this man who sort of struggled to sleep for the rest of his life and, you know, scored an FA Cup hat trick. I mean, first goal aside, you know, we can be.
But it's credited to him.
It's credited to him, but I think it's almost a great tragedy, as is his playing by Gavin Rossdale in The Game of Their Lives, which is a American film of their 1950 World Cup win, in which he sounds.
So like, when the US beat England 1-0.
Yeah, exactly. And Mortensen sounds like, well, like me. You know, this guy from County Durham, he sounds like a member of the Bullingdon Club. He's sort of like cast in that sort of very condescending, imperial era kind of British man. Mm-hmm. And it's a great shame.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Carrying on with Stan Mortensen and what he could do on the pitch, there was no doubt about that free kick he took.
Oh, he could kick a ball, though.
You know, I mean, my goodness, you know, questionable where the wall was and all that kind of stuff.
Well, but yeah, it is, but it's not that questionable. I mean, essentially, so it's a free kick just to the left of goal, what, 22 yards out, maybe? A
couple of yards outside, just on a slight angle as well. Mm-hmm.
And absolutely lashes it past as he's looking at the left side of the wall into the top corner. So I guess the same sort of position that Jeff Hurst scores his hat-trick goal from 66 World Cup final. Mm-hmm. But, so, I mean...
It was a great strike.
Yeah,
sure you, is. Yeah. You, 1 minute to go as well.
Yeah.
I know you mean about the wall, but equally, I don't think the wall has to be very far out of position.
Yeah, to be fair to those players, and the heavy ball, you wouldn't want to.
I'm not putting my face in the way of that.
There might have been just a little bit of left to right movement on that. I mean, I know the idea of curling the ball around walls was didn't really come in till the Brazilians in the late 50s and early 60s, but there might have been a little bit of left to right movement on it. But he hammers it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the last minute to equalise. I mean, they're probably looking at that thinking, this is our last chance. This is the game here. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, thunders the ball home, as you say, 1 minute to go.
But the game's still not about him somehow. No.
Yeah, well, that's right. And then of course, in injury time, the ball finds Matthews once again out on the right wing and once again drops the shoulder and goes on the outside of the defender.
I think why I find that sort of that passage of play interesting, those last few minutes where Blackpool's game plan becomes solely to feed the ball to Matthews, is that I think it's very descriptive of what football was in England at the time. So you have this systemic weakness in the WM where, you know, because of the fullbacks, you're always going to have space for one of your wingers, and so that becomes the way English teams play.
Yeah, I mean, just to explain that, yes, in a little bit more detail, the idea of turning a defence, which is a term you still hear now, but I think it's changed its meaning. But now it sort of means you play the ball in behind them and you make them turn 180 degrees. In those days, it meant you took the ball down the left wing. So if you imagine you've got a winger, a centre forward, and a right winger, so the right back goes to the winger, the centre back sort of leaves the centre forward to come and support him. So then the left back tucks in to cover. So if you can then play a crossfield ball, mm-hmm. your right winger has got acceleration room. So when the left back tries to get out to him, he's already moving at pace.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you've got a player moving at pace at a player who's sort of trying to move back into position, you don't have to do very much. As Stanley Matthews very rarely did very much. I mean, you know, the most famous English player till the 80s, probably. And yet all he ever did was one trick.
I suppose if you've got that sort of, you've got the ability to exploit that weakness with a player like Matthews and a centre forward like Mortensen, because yes, Matthews is going to beat a player, but he's also a good crosser of the ball.
Yeah.
Mortensen is a sort of he's a barrel of a centre forward, really. It's a combination that unless it's challenged from outside, you don't really have to vary that much. It's interesting. It must have been in the late 80s. My father bought me this sort of mechanical football game. It's like a sort of mechanical Sabutio, really, where...
I know the one.
You know the one, yeah. Right? And the players move up and down the field and grooves. Yeah, yeah. And it's a little bit like watching that. If you watch the whole game, you see, you know, the ball moves from left to right, as Jonathan explained, because that's the way you open space and exploit it. But it's very much players picking up the ball and charging forward.
Oh, it's all in straight lines.
Exactly that. And if you watch even just those few minutes after Mortensen's equaliser, Blackburn run the same move again and again and again. And it's just interesting to see how... It's interesting to see how little adaption there is to it. If that was to happen now, if you were to have a vulnerability that you needed to protect in the last few minutes of a cup final, you know, managers have all sorts of solutions that they would employ to, you know, to bank up a fragility, to harden a fragility. And yet Matthews wins the game by doing the same thing that he's been trying to do really for 15 minutes, which is very... He doesn't win the game. He creates the opportunity, which wins the game. But it's very descriptive, and it's also...
Well, I think one of the reasons for that is that when two WMs meet each other, so if it's a 3-2-2-3, if you want to imagine it like that, each player has a direct opponent. Mm-hmm. So I think people were discouraged from thinking about the team as a whole. Mm-hmm. You just thought about your immediate opponent. And this idea of switching the play, that was the one clever twist to that.
Yeah.
And of course, as soon as Brazil come in 1958 playing the back four, even Hungary later in the year, which we'll get on to, playing a quasi back four, suddenly that acceleration room isn't there because you've got effectively two centre backs. So you're not asking the left back to cover the centre half. You've got the two centre backs there anyway, so the left back can get on with protecting, defending against the winger.
Yeah.
So that winning goal, we should describe.
We should mention the South African-born Bill Perry.
Yeah. So Matthews gets to the line, drags it back, low cross. Maybe he was aiming for Mortensen near post.
Sort of in his autobiography, in his second autobiography, he says he was, and he says he saw Mortensen moving away from the ball, and he got discouraged, so he sort of rolled over towards the photographers on the touchline, and he. And then saw Perry closing in.
So Perry, the South African-born Bondi Hansberg, as you say, left winger coming in. So I mean, it ends up sort of being right in the middle of a goal and side foot. It's a very Manchester City goal, which I think is interesting.
Very modern Manchester City goal, yeah.
In that Guardiola has almost moved back to a WM, and he's now scoring one of the types of goals that the WM used to produce. They're not scoring the big cross of the back post type goal, but they score a lot of that goal where the winger gets to the line, cuts it back.
Yeah.
And then players running in have a relatively easy finish.
And it's interesting because we've mentioned it enough times there how Matthews, it's called the Matthews final, not the Mortensen final. As soon as the final whistle goes, a fair few of those Bolton players immediately go over to Matthews.
Loftus as well is one of them. Supposedly, rumour has it, or legend has it.
In a friendly manner, I should
absolutely
say.
Absolutely, yeah, not to. No, I,
in a congratulatory kind of attitude and a full of praise for his performance.
Yeah, really. I mean, I think if you take Matthews' life as a whole, I think it's deserving. I mean, I, Le Morte's an argument is obvious. Of course, everyone's made that one. But if you think of the things he did, in, especially towards the end of his life, like I think he goes in the 70s to Soweto to coach South African players. He goes into townships at a time when it would have been very, very dangerous for a white man to go into a township. And he's coaching, and he's providing sponsorship for this little squad of, I think they're called Sustans boys. He organised tours to Brazil for them and stuff. And
he was instrumental in getting Steve McKone, who's the first black professional to play.
Really?
First black South African to play professionally in Europe. Mm. That Matthews had played against him on a tour in mid-50s, I think.
Okay.
Or maybe early 50s. I think McKone came over, I think he played for Coventry in 56, made his debut. So, early 50s, Matthews had seen him. And so, I mean, there was a lot of South Africans playing in the English leagues.
Yeah.
I wonder if Perry was part of introducing him to South Africa. But yeah, as you say, going to Soweto in the 70s.
It's, I mean, you can still find footage of that. There's a, I cannot for the life of me remember the name of it. It's a documentary. It's a little bit VHS-y, and I saw it on YouTube a few years ago. But of him with the boys, and he's in his modern boots and everything, and he must be... Well, he would have been about the early 70s, late 60s by then. And it's just, it's very affecting. And I like the idea of, I'm a bit of a football romantic, and I like the idea of someone like that having the emblem of that game. It's very, I don't want to draw a kind of a sort of portrait of Englishness comparison. I don't think that's the time of the political climate to do that kind of thing. I can deal without the Twitter reaction to it. But it's just his life is very... There's a very wholesome aspect to it.
Yeah.
Divorce aside.
I'm interested you say that, because you've read both his autobiographies.
I read this. The first one I treat with a little bit of... I keep it at arm's length, because there's a few oddities between the two in my experience. Yeah.
I thought you were somebody who actually came out of his own autobiography quite badly. Not as badly as, say, Peter Shilton comes out of his.
Oh, well, yeah.
But there's an awkward tone to some of it. I mean, definitely the way he treated the England manager, Walter Winterbottom, looks pretty backward now. You know, his sort of total distrust of the idea of tactics or team building, his attitude to various things. I mean, it's almost certainly filtered through a ghost, and probably... It's a tonal issue rather than anything else. But
do you think that's a product of the time, then? Because obviously Winterbottom, I suppose Winterbottom is your kind of Andre Villas-Boas of his time. He was an intellectual. He read Homer, and like he was a guy that came along.
No, I mean, he genuinely did.
It seems to have been an attitude that was shared. I mean, he kind of. Some very disparaging comments associated with Lawton as well at the time about kind of, well, what can you teach me about playing, playing football? And it's,
but Lawton had been dropped by England for making his big money move to Notts County.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Lawton had an axe to grind. Matthews, look, Matthews got every right to criticise Winterbottom. I don't know Winterbottom at all.
Yeah.
The only sort of contact you get with him is his occasional awful co-commentary stints. I think he's co-commentator with Wilsonholm on the 68.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, Seb, is
European Cup final.
Yeah, is this idea that these teams playing in straight lines and the basic tactics, if there were tactics, of course. And it is extraordinary when you look back on it, just how basic. Although we have likened one of their goals to a modern day Man City goal.
Well, that's what I find absolutely fascinating.
Completion of the circle, though, isn't it? Really?
Yeah,
and yet. And you hinted at it right at the beginning. In a sense, this game showed you everything that was also wrong with English football.
Yes. No wonder Hungary took them apart.
Well, it's this veneration of the winger and the refusal to look at anything else. Mm-hmm. And then Hungary turn up not playing a back four, although a lot of people say they did play a back four. They played a back three with Zakariash very, very deep in midfield. Mm-hmm. So it was a hair's breadth from being a 4-2-4, but it wasn't quite a 4-2-4. And Hungary absolutely played them off the park. I mean, 6-3 sounds embarrassing. England got away with that. That game could have been...
And then they played again soon after, and it was
7-1, yeah.
Just to, so take the aggregate score. it is a demolishing.
And even then, I think England got away with it.
This is the thing,
Marcus. Might I say, Seb, very quickly, is that, and I will say this, political climate, take it into consideration, it shows you the stubbornness of the English. which was brutally exposed by the Hungarians.
Well, I think it, in many ways, Marcus, because it's sort of the fallacy is that Nanda Haidakuti comes out of nowhere, and this is the first time that England have ever seen a deep lying forward, and it's this great mystery, and you just don't know what to do with it. It's not really true. England have experienced it before, but they sort of have this. I mean, as actually some of those comments in Matthew's autobiography allude to, they have this rejection of outside influence in this kind of this total belief in the primacy of English football and English techniques and strength and shoulder barging and clattering into tackles. Well,
and there's the stubbornness, you know.
Yeah.
But it's. I mean, the problem is it's very easy to superimpose subsequent events on
that. Oh, of course, yeah.
And I have a certain... I mean, all of it's true. There is a blinkedness. There is an insularity. Where I have a certain sympathy is that 4-0 win in Turin was an extraordinary performance.
It's an anomaly, really, in a way.
Well, they hammered Portugal. They put 10 past Portugal, a decent Portugal team. They kept on slipping up. They kept on getting away with it. But if you looked at that forward line, that's the England forward line of the late 40s, early 50s, when you had... I mean, there was a point where you could have played Lawton as your centre-forward, Lawton as an inside forward, Matthews on the right, Finney on the left... And Mannion at inside left. Yeah. I mean, that's an extraordinary forward line.
I think that's the last time they played together for England, isn't it?
48, probably. Yeah, against Italy probably was, because Lawton disappeared soon afterwards. And Mannion, of course, went on strike as well to try and force a move to Oldham, slightly strangely.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was playing for Middlesbrough, so you can see why he was trying to get away.
Context is crucial, isn't it?
Yeah. But I also think it's, you know, when you have a game like this, which whatever our... doubts about the quality of it, and very exciting game, two goals in an 89th minute and 92nd minute winner. You have this sort of Stanley Matthews, the great 38-year-old, the man who's seen as being this embodiment of football, and all that's sort of beautiful and artistic in football, and he finally gets the medal he's never won through his career. And there's talk of people in the press box standing on the desks and celebrating, which would be very much frowned upon today, and I assume was frowned upon even more back then.
And Datico was on the phone before you got home.
So everybody's celebrating the winger, and the winger's actually the thing that marks England out as being backward and holding them back. Yes, there's an insularity there, but it was also... But there are pretty good reasons for them not to see the coming tide.
That was the Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. We're back next week with another classic game, so do not miss it. See you soon.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.